Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I am Chris Scully.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Today we have an interview with climatologist Rick Thoman from Fairbanks, Alaska.
Then, a new episode of Schenectady Today with Ann Perillo about the Albany Civic Theater's production of The Heiress.
And later on, we hear Adam Tinkle tell us about Feel Me, a multi-sensory art exhibition that will be running until October 12th at Colorworks on River Street in Troy.
After that, Willie Terry brings us the sights, sounds, and tastes of the Albany Vegan Festival that happened on Sunday, September 8th at the Albany Capital Center.
And finally, we'll have a live interview with Sandy Stubing and Mark Dunley of PAWS, People of Albany United for Safe Energy. But first, headlines.
The Times Union reports that a new study found that people with disabilities generated more than $55 million in economic impact in the capital region last year. However, more work still needs to be done to expand inclusive job opportunities that allow those with disabilities to participate in the economy. The unemployment rate for New York's disabled population is 14.4%, more than double the official unemployment rate. Disabled New Yorkers are 2.6 times more likely to live in poverty than those without disabilities, one of the worst rates in the country.
Governor Andrew Cuomo announced on Sunday that his administration will take emergency executive action this week to ban the sale of flavored electronic cigarettes in New York. The Troy Record also reported that Cuomo will propose legislation to ban deceptive marketing of e-cigarettes to teens and children. State Supreme Court Justice Henry F. Swack sided with the Troy Police Benevolent Association for the third time in a case involving arbitration about back pay and benefits owed by the city. Mayor Patrick Madden sent the city's labor attorneys to stop the arbitration, but the court dismissed the city's arguments.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. So in our first segment today, we have Rick Thoman, who is a climatologist with the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. He spoke over the phone with myself about ice melt, fires, and lightning in the Arctic. I'm here with climatologist Rick Thoman, who is with the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. How are you doing, Rick?
Just great. Thanks for having me, Alexis.
Would you mind just giving us some of your background as a climatologist?
Sure. I've been working 36 years in the weather and climate business. Much of my career was spent as a weather forecaster, 5 years in the private sector, and then 30 years with the National Weather Service, 25 of that as a forecaster, and then I finished up my career as the climate program manager for Alaska Region National Weather Service.
We're getting a lot of news about extreme weather events happening in Alaska right now. For example, the retreat of the sea ice from greater than 150 miles from the shore. What is actually happening in Alaska and the Arctic region right now? What are you seeing, and how does that compare to when you began your career almost 40 years ago?
So Alaska is coming off one of the warmest summers of record, according to NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. For the summer as a whole, this was 2019 was the second warmest summer of record, and July was the warmest month, not just the warmest July, but the warmest month in the last century in Alaska. That's as far back as we have statewide records. So this has had profound implications. We've had a big wildfire year, 2.59 million acres burned. That's the sixth largest wildfire season in the last 50 years. When you burn that much boreal forest, of course, produces an immense amount of smoke. So even places far from the flames, direct health impacts from these wildfires. During August, we had utterly unprecedented fires in the southern part of mainland Alaska, both north and south of Anchorage, the largest population center. It's not that those areas don't get fires, but they almost invariably are early in the season before things moisten up in the course of the summer. But not this year. That part of Alaska had their warmest summer and also driest summer. So really quite the lethal combination, and sparked some very damaging wildfires. Sea ice, as you mentioned, is way far away from Alaska, Arctic-wide so far. According to the National Snow and Ice Data Center analysis, we are at the fourth lowest total Arctic ice extent. Near Alaska, though, it's actually even worse, in that there is no ice anywhere close to Alaska and hasn't been since early August. Right now, there's some very low concentration ice about 150 miles northeast of the northeast corner of Alaska. But in the Chukchi Sea, that's kind of the sea northwest of the coast of Alaska, there is no ice now within 450, 500 miles. And these are areas that in the past, when I started my career in the 1980s, typically in September, the ice would be in what we thought was a low ice year, would be maybe 100 miles offshore. In a high ice year, it would be very close to the shore, even at this time of year. So the changes are really, they're very stark. They're very noticeable, not just from the professional viewpoint, but from the people that live in these regions. They are all acutely aware of how much things have changed, not over the course of history, but just in their own personal experience. Anybody over the age of 50 remembers when it was very, very different than it is now.
And I want to come back to that generational point, but staying on the topic of unprecedented weather events, there was recently lightning near the North Pole. How does this happen, and why is it such a big deal?
Well, some of it, so why is it a big deal? Well, the fact that we are able to even to determine that such a thing happened, that's relatively new. So just to have the remote sensing capabilities to determine that. So we can't really say, oh, this has never happened before. We would simply didn't have any mechanism to monitor whether such a thing happened before. How could that happen? Well, it doesn't happen the way most thunderstorms in the Mohawk Valley happen, as a result of heating of the ground and that warm air rising and producing thunderstorms. Near the North Pole, even in this very low ice year, it's still ice covered. So what happened during that event actually is you had very warm, moist air moving from eastern Siberia northward, being pushed north by the jet stream. And that air at the middle levels of the atmosphere was warm and unstable enough that with a little bit of help higher up in the atmosphere, some cooling aloft, actually enabled the thunderstorms to grow in the middle and upper levels of the atmosphere, and were able to produce some lightning strikes. That's really notable for a couple of reasons. First of all, to get lightning, of course, you need both water and ice in the clouds. And at 85 or 86 north, just a few hundred miles from the North Pole, of course, it's even in summer, it's usually cold enough in the mid-levels of the atmosphere that there's not much water vapor. Most of what there is ice. And so to be able to get that much water cloud instead of ice is really quite notable.
Okay, so going back to people who were born 50 years ago, remembering what the sea ice used to be like, younger generations now, people, for example, people who were born after 2000, they're old enough to vote. You've talked in previous interviews about people saying, oh, this summer was cool, when really it was only relatively cool compared to the last year. How do you think that relative temperature affects, you know, public opinion compared to when you're looking at a 50-year time span?
Well, that's a really good question. People, of course, are very, very adaptive to where they live and the conditions in where they live, and so it's perfectly natural to and most people do it. You know, okay, how is this year compared to the last year or the last few? That's there's nothing unreasonable about that. I think the important thing to take from that, though, is yes, maybe it was cooler than the last few years. But if we want to use that if we want to use what's happening now to get a sense of the future, we have to put it into that longer context. One of the things that sometimes get bandied about is, this is the new normal, as if the system is at a plateau. And for many things, there's no reason to think that we're at a plateau. This is just where we're at now. And when we look at the longer time scale, we can see that for many things, the escalator is on the move. And what seems cool now in the future will seem cold, but people will be comparing it to the last few years of wherever we're at in the future. So I think it's important when we want to try to get a handle on the future that we're cognizant of the past, and that's why these longer time series and the memories of the older people in our society become so valuable.
So we have just about a minute left for this segment. I want to touch on those memories that you mentioned. There are many lifestyles and different cultures at risk here. Can you just explain how this unprecedented summer has affected those lifestyles on the coast?
Well, here in Alaska, our indigenous communities are very resilient. They've been here for thousands of years, the cultures, and they'll get through this, whatever this is, whatever the future brings. But we have to recognize that comes at a cost, at a risk, and as the conditions change, the old knowledge becomes less applicable. That doesn't mean it's not valued, but particularly things like ice conditions changing or longer open water seasons, we just have to do things differently in some regards, especially in the mechanics of acquiring resources and making a living off the land and the sea and the ice where it's still there. So people adapt, but it comes at a considerable cost, both economic cost and a cultural cost as well.
This has been part one of our interview with Rick Thoman, and for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And that was my co-host Alexis Goldsmith interviewing Rick Thoman about the climate in the Arctic.
Okay, so up next, Schenectady Today host Ann Perillo speaks with Evan Jones, director, Ron Weber, and Susan Dance about the Albany Civic Theater's production of The Heiress.
Right now, we are talking about The Heiress, and I have two of the characters. One... not so sure about you, aren't Rob? He's kind of a mean guy, isn't he?
He is. He is a mean guy.
Evan is the director here. Evan. Yeah, Jones. Go ahead.
Yes, he is a fairly mean guy. He's a successful doctor in the mid-19th century, and he's pretty overbearing with his daughter and the rest of his household.
And he's kind of mad at her because she survived childbirth and
yes,
his wife didn't. Right?
Yes, and so his wife died in childbirth with the daughter, and he always hoped that the daughter would grow up to become just like his memory of his wife, which was an extremely graceful and
beautiful,
outgoing, beautiful
yeah.
person, and the daughter is very shy, so she's constantly disappointing him.
Yeah, it's a sad story, isn't it? Evan, what do you think?
It is, and that was what attracted me to it, was that it's so dramatic and it's so intense, but it's also very relatable.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's even though the play is over 70 years old and the book it's based on was written even well before that, it's still relevant.
I have to say, every time it's on TV, I watch it. Lavinia, tell me about you. This isn't really Lavinia, but Susan, yes.
Lavinia is Dr. Sloper's sister, who is a widowed woman who comes to live with Dr. Sloper and take care of his niece, be her confidant. And she believes in love, and she wants Catherine desperately to find happiness. She believes in romance, and she so wants Catherine to be happy.
Up to the very end?
Yes, up to the very, very end.
And we're not telling you how it ends, but anyway.
And I deal with my brother just like any siblings deal with their family, a little harsh, a little, but I definitely, definitely love my niece and want her to be happy.
And who else is in the play? Because we have, of course, the Catherine, and we have...
But Heather Liz Copps is Catherine.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Yeah, she's great. Brian Sheldon is playing Morris,
Brian is playing Morris. Oh, my gosh.
And then... That's
the suitor.
Jimmy Cupp, Samantha Mioren,
Laura Darling.
Laura Darling.
Oh, you got a good cast.
Yeah.
Sarah Papini.
Sarah Papini and... Terry is also
Terry. Yeah, Terry Stordy plays my other sister.
Yeah. Well, there's more in the play there's more characters, it seems.
Yeah. The play's a cast of nine.
Six
women and three men.
Yeah. So, and you picked it because you thought that this would be a really relevant.
Yeah. I knew it would be a good selection for Albany Civic. You know, it's a female.
It's a classic.
It's a classic. It's a female-centric show. It gives us a chance to show off these wonderful costumes and the acting
ability.
Well,
we got the photos. Can we bring up those photos? My gosh, those are amazing, the photos that they brought over. Yeah. And I love the dress that you're wearing in that one going up the stairs. Or I don't know who's wearing it.
That's Heather Liz.
That's
Heather Liz.
Look at that dress. Yeah. Where on earth did you get the costumes?
Our costumer is Beth Ruman, and she is the best ever.
Yes.
She costumes everyone. She is making most of the dresses that you will see in this play.
Oh, my gosh.
She told me the other day she's used over 100 yards of fabric so far.
I can believe it with the size of my hoop skirt.
She's amazing.
Yeah, so this, I love period pieces too. What are you wearing? You don't have to wear a hoop or anything.
No, not a hoop. I wear a period coat, a very heavy wool, long black coat, which makes it challenging under the hot lights,
but it's very authentic. I hope I can get to see it because I just love the play. And it's such a, if you've never been to the Albany Civic Theater, it's worth a trip because it's a very intimate theater. And I know I sat in the front row a couple of times, and I think for Rocky Horror and a couple of others, but anyway, I felt like I was on the stage.
Yeah, if you're, Albany Civic Theater is pretty tight. If you are in the front row, you see every single thing that happens on stage. It almost happens on top of you. But
I love it. I love it.
And there's also brand new seats that were just installed for people to try out.
Oh, good.
So that's something to look forward to,
along
with the play.
Yeah, good. And they're over on, I think, 235
Second Avenue.
Wow.
I just scared myself that I remembered that. 235 Second over in Albany. Please support your local theater groups. These people are all volunteers. You don't get paid. And believe me, when they do a production, we're talking 6 weeks out of your life.
Oh, yeah. Longer.
You're there. Well, yeah, for you, probably. Yeah,
six weeks of rehearsal before we even
go on the stage, and that's not even counting 3 weeks of production.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I want to applaud you because I know the effort that it takes. I've been in theater, never into big productions, but it takes a lot of effort. Whether you've got a small part or a big part, mm-hmm. it's still a lot of time and effort. And these people are doing it for the love of theater.
Yeah.
And you too, right?
Yes, and I want to point out this is not an easy play, and I'm not taking it easy on my actors.
Whoa!
we're all holding ourselves
to
this high
standard. You're not getting Christmas cards this year,
Kat. As long as I get good performances, they can keep their Christmas cards.
They are very challenging characters. Yeah. They're complicated relationships. And it is a challenge to find the sweet spot in these characters where you don't want to make them too angry in a moment or too nice in a moment.
Subtleness is what it's all about, except that you're on the stage and you have to emote that. Mm-hmm. So that there's where the fine line comes. It's like if you were on TV and you got a microphone right next to you, that's one thing, but you have to project and you have to project the emotion.
There's a lot of emotion, a lot of emotion, really.
It's a highly emotional show. It is a drama, but it is not without comedy. There are very funny moments in the play. But it's a very challenging piece to tackle. And from my point of view, I think we've done a great job.
I think you have, too. You will, I'm sure. I'm not worried about you at all, Evan, because you've done a lot of theater. I know that. I want to tell you all to break a leg.
Thank you.
Because you want to get out there and do that, get on that stage. So how can they get tickets, and when is it?
You can buy tickets at albanycivictheatre.org. They make it really easy on their website. You can buy them at the door. You can call the box office ahead of time. There's all sorts of ways to get tickets.
Okay.
Please come see the show.
Yes, please.
You can even volunteer to usher at the performances and then get free tickets.
So you need
ushers,
one
way.
Too. Yeah. That's really good.
Albany Civic Theater, along with most theaters, but Albany Civic Theater is, they always look for volunteers. And if you usher the play, you get to watch the play for free.
Yeah, that's really nice. Got every opportunity to go see this play. You will not be disappointed. And I think it's good for probably anyone from 12 on up.
Yes, that's fair, yeah.
Yeah, I think 12, absolutely. 13 on up, because they'll understand the subtleties of what's going on.
And
maybe learn a few lessons, who knows?
I hope so.
And to learn more about the Albany Civic Center or Civic Theater, or to purchase tickets for The Heiress, you can go to www.albanycivictheatre.org or call the box office at 518-462-1297. The show will run on Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 3 p.m.
If you're just joining us, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Chris Scully. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or a book suggestion, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary. Okay, up next, Feel Me is a multi-sensory art exhibition that will be running until October 12th. At Colorworks on River Street in Troy. WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati went there on opening night and spoke with Adam Tinkle, a musician and video artist who is exhibiting a multimedia piece at the exhibition. In this segment, they talk about the nature and purpose of the exhibition and about Adam's installation there.
This is Aaron Pettinati, and I am at the Colorworks Gallery for the opening of Feel Me, an exhibition curated by Kelsey Renko, which is a multimedia art installation that's about multisensory experience. And I am with one of the artists who is exhibiting work at the opening. That is Adam Tinkle.
Hi, how's it going?
And I want to ask you, Adam, about this event overall and then a little bit more about your piece. But can you just tell us about the event?
So Kelsey Renko, who's a Troy-based painter and a member of the board of directors of the Colorworks Gallery, which is a artist-run space on River Street here in Troy. This is the first show she's curating here at Colorworks, and I think she was just interested in the senses and in art that explores the senses more broadly than we ordinarily think of in the visual art, fine art context, where focus is usually so much on the visual. So this exhibition has things that are edible and drinkable. It has two pieces that have a smell component. It has pieces you can really enter into and touch, tactile art. Two of the exhibiting artists are actually like food purveying businesses, Lil Deb's Oasis, a restaurant in Hudson, and Yes Folk Tonics, the kombucha maker based here in Troy. And my piece is way in the back room and is a 3-channel abstract video installation.
Something I've noticed just moving around and experiencing these pieces is this almost synesthetic component where one sense can be provoked through another sense. Your piece, which we'll talk about a little bit more, had that quality to it. But also there are pieces that involve things like videos of roller coaster rides and...
Goldie Poblador's piece has something you can drink in it, but then there's a smell chamber... Two smell chambers, and the idea is the drink will taste different depending on what you're smelling, because the sense of taste is affected by the sense of smell. I think that's a really astute observation, Aaron, that we often think of the senses as individual channels of experience, but actually they like cross, there's crosstalk between the senses, and one sense influences the other, and synesthesia is that, but it's also a kind of an everyday experience. It doesn't need to fall under a kind of like clinical definition. Like,
and also the provoking of memory through sense, that seems to be a recurrent motif of various installations.
Yeah, there's a piece, a video piece by Montreal-based artist Nicole Bull, which is, it's kind of an essayistic exploration of that idea, like the scent of a detergent evoking memory. And then the Yes Folk installation is meant to evoke a memory from Mexico that's invoked through text and also the design of a kitchen-like space and also the taste of this beverage, Tejuino, which is being served up right now at the opening.
I tasted that, and it definitely was profoundly evocative of Mexican cuisine. So let's talk about your piece. It's a triptych, in a sense. So the three screens, there's a central screen and then two screens at a 45-degree angle, and there are abstract geometric shapes projected on the screen. And sometimes they seem to be vibrating in tandem with each other, and then other times they break up into individual pieces. And there's also this quality, at least towards the beginning of the piece, of abstract straight lines in the central screen and then like more amorphous blobular sorts of shapes on the side. But then those lines start to break down a bit and the piece seems to be sort of working together towards a larger abstract shape or form that's being evoked through the vibrations of the various shapes. And then behind that, at the same time, there's also a tone that's being played of varying intensity, and the intensity seems to be correlated to the vibrations of the shapes. So can you just talk about that, what you were trying to evoke there?
Well, it's a great description of like kind of what happens in the piece or of one experience of the piece. From the angle of process, the angle of how it's made and what it means, it's like a pretty different story, because it really has to do with a gift of disused pieces of technology that somebody gave me, something that, you know, was going to be trashed, stuff that people thought didn't have any value and didn't really quite know how the various things would plug into one another. I saw this pile of stuff, an old video mixer, some old cameras, old TV monitors, cables, and because I had a bit of experience with analog video, I like instantly knew that this was a system that would fit together that would allow me to make videos in ways that would be very difficult to do with kind of up-to-date current technology. Analog video signals, unlike digital video, they're not represented as frames. It's represented as like a continuous analog signal that makes it easier to get certain kinds of effects with feedback. So all of the videos are created through feedback and with really an attempt to move very gently from like one state of sort of self-oscillation of this video system, where either a camera is pointed at a monitor that's displaying what that camera is seeing, and that is being run through some sort of signal processing, or sometimes a cable from an output of a video system is just being plugged directly back into that input. So there's no optical phase that that video ever goes through. It's just signal sort of eating itself, like a snake eating its own tail. So all of the elements in the installation are created that way, and I adjust the parameters of what the system is doing, but I try to do so as gently as possible, and that is like a practice that is in some ways kind of associated with meditative, mindful states, trying to move slowly. And then also seeking things that I think are visually striking and avoiding strong evocations and trying to just look at what the system kind of wants to do on its own without human intervention, and kind of gently steering that or moving into that, trying to look at the inherencies and tendencies of these systems as a way of trying to be present with technology and experience technology with fewer of the representational purposes that video is usually put towards. So I've been doing improvisations with the system for like 5 years and have long wanted to cut together a piece from those improvisations. I also perform with musicians in a more momentary responsive way. But for this, I was just trying to look for rhythmic, vibrational, graphical, coloristic affinities between these different improvisations I've done over a long period of time and make a kind of narrative that builds from less motion, less intensity to more and then back to less so that people can encounter it in any place within the 15-minute loop and get taken on a pretty gentle journey from things that are maybe a little bit easier to look at into something that really is kind of throttling and hopefully gives you an experience of looking that is not like one you've had before.
That rhythm component of it was definitely a major component of how I experienced the piece. I actually honestly still feel like I'm coming down from it right now because there is like a sort of trippy AF component to what you did there. That one of the academic discourses around technology right now concerns the agency of systems themselves, of technologies, and the idea that they exert a kind of agential force of their own. And by the end of this experience, I definitely felt like my own mind's ability to wrap some sort of conceptual frame around the experience that I was undergoing had been broken down by the sheer excess and the crazy oscillating rhythms of what you're doing. Is that something that you were getting at, the agency of analog systems, the ways that they exert a kind of force or power on us?
Definitely. I have to think more about agency and what, but certainly their inherencies, their tendencies, their ontologies, you know, like what are video systems? What are their building blocks? And what if we look closely at what they do in a state of sort of self-actuation instead of bending them towards the purposes of representation, which is what they're almost always being asked to do. So sometimes I just zoom in on more or less the kind of atomic building blocks of these older video systems. And because there's lower resolution, part of what you're seeing is like just low resolution, but there's also something gained and something lost with each step forward in technology. And so kind of the energy and the rhythm that these systems produce or that I've gotten them to produce is something that's very difficult to do with current up-to-date digital video equipment. So it's partially like an elegy for interesting, cool things that older video systems could do more easily, and partially, yeah, meditation with technology. I've also been thinking a lot in the context of this exhibition, Feel Me, about like forest bathing and this idea of like multisensory washing and bathing as like a therapeutic practice and the relation between the senses and like mind, sense of wellness or transportedness, and like implementing the kind of sense of the possibility of what the sort of abstraction of nature, like the fact that nature doesn't care about you and like it's more complicated than anything you can wrap your head around. That sort of seems to be like part of what makes forest bathing a rich experience. So I was thinking about this as like screen bathing, or like that video too, the technology too, has this kind of excess, as you said, of information in the same way that a forest does, and that excess can grant us something. Don't know exactly what, but
well, so when I asked earlier what were you trying to evoke, it was kind of a misformulated question, because in a sense you're not really trying to evoke anything. You're just trying to get us to be with these technologies and feel what they emanate, feel their vibrations in some way, and also to see what that does to us at a perceptual level. I can share one experience that I had while I was watching it, which was that while it was going on, a guy with really bad body odor sat down right next to me. And at first, the reaction that I had to it was sort of unpleasant, but then I was like, okay, there's just there's something about this experience that's meditative and profound. And so I ought to just sort of go with this. I ought to just absorb the bad body odor as part of the analog component of this experience and be okay with it and feel it. Your thoughts on that?
I love it. That's a great note to end on and to urge people to get over to Collar Works over on River Street in North Troy and experience Feel Me.
Great. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Aaron.
And that was Aaron Pettinati speaking with Adam Tinkle about his exhibition entitled Feel Me.
So in our next segment, our own HMM roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry takes us to the Albany Vegan Festival, which took place on Sunday, September 8th at the Albany Capital Center. In this segment, you will hear his interview with various vendors at the festival.
Yo, this is Willie Terry, the Roman Labor Correspondent, still here at the Vegan Fest, and I'm at a booth called the Vegan Outfitter. And believe it or not, this is a group that's located in Troy, and I have as my guest the owner.
Yeah, Jed Civic.
And Susan Civic.
No. How y'all doing?
We're doing fine, thank you.
Right, so we're at the Vegan Fest, and you have sneakers and shirts and leather jackets. Tell me something, how that fit in with the Vegan Fest.
Okay, well, the jackets aren't real leather. Nothing here is real leather. Nothing came from an animal. There's no leather, wool, silk, or anything from an animal. The glues that hold the shoes together are not animal-derived. That's what makes it vegan. And, you know, we've been vegan for 27 years, so
almost
we just...
28.
Almost 28. I lose track. And that's why we... wanted to do something that promoted veganism, so this is what we came up with.
You're saying you've been in business for 28 years?
No.
No. Oh, you've been vegan for 28 years?
Gotcha. 28 years, mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, where are you located?
We're at 465 Fulton Street in Troy.
So tell me something, how did you get into this business?
When we took the space, we originally thought that was going to be some sort of cafe serving just a light fare or something like that. And when we researched it enough, we realized that it's way too involved. A huge undertaking, which Susan and I were not ready to do. So we started to think, how else can we promote veganism? And we thought, well, you know what? Footwear is something that a lot of vegans have trouble with when they go into the store to look for non-leather stuff. They're spending all their time checking for materials instead of trying on shoes. So we decided, you know what? Shoes are a good item to carry because they're not perishable. It's not like they need refrigeration. Okay, so we decided to offer this. And we're open Wednesdays and Thursdays from 12 noon to 7 p.m. Fridays from 12 noon to 8 p.m. Saturday from 10 to 8 p.m. And Sunday from 11 to 5. Okay. And there are some days where we will close because we're doing a veg fest.
And just one last question. How is business?
Good question. The business started off slowly until people started to find out about us, and it is still slowly growing. There are some good days, there are some not good days, okay? But it's a matter of having some patience, and we believe in the product, and we believe in what we're doing.
And thank you. I want to thank you. And that's your name again?
I'm Jed, J-E-D.
Okay, that's Jay from the Vegan
Outfitter.
All right, thank you, Jay. And thank you, Susan.
Oh, you're welcome.
Still at the Vegan Fest, and I'm at a booth called the Kitchen Craft. And the owner is Chef Bruce and Gloria Kitchen.
Ketchum.
All right, almost like ketchup.
Like ketchup with an M. There you go.
And they have a lot of pots on the table at the Vegan Fest, and I'm going to ask them a question of how do these pots fit in with the Vegan Fest?
That's a great question.
All right,
Willie.
Bruce.
Hey, Willie, the reason they fit in well with Vegan Fest is just any other fest is that people eat food. And the idea of cooking with our cookware is that you keep 70% of the nutrition in the food instead of boiling it away. We cook without any water in the vegetables. We cook vegetables with no water, including corn on the cob. And if you're eating meats, if you're not a vegan, if you're not a vegetarian, you eat meats. We cook without any grease or oil, so you can, and it's fast. You can cook a baked potato in our pot on the stovetop in under 15 minutes. Done, and the flavor's amazing. Just like our vegetables, the flavor is amazing. With no salt, no butter added. Great way to lose weight, lower cholesterol, blood pressure, all everything.
Now, this is with your pot. Did you discover this, or you?
No, I did not. I'm fairly new with the company. We're a 113-year-old American-made cookware company. We're the only cookware company that can say that we're both sourced and made in America. Only Americans. It takes 9,000 people, employees, 9,000 people to bring this cookware to you in your home when you buy it. Because some work in the steel mills in Pennsylvania, different where it's processed, the handles. It takes a total of about 9,000 people to produce this cookware.
Oh, okay. And now what's the difference between the regular pots we buy at Walmart and your pot?
I guess what's the difference between a Yugo and a Rolls Royce? If you buy anything at Walmart, it's either going to be one of two things. Either raw aluminum cookware, which is the worst thing in the world you could cook on, and also 90% of restaurants are using it, by the way, in the back. Or it's a color, like a chemical. It's going to be the blue, the copper, the different colored cookwares. Those are all chemical surfaces. People actually think, Willie, that when it says copper pot, that it's a copper pot. It's only copper paint. It's a chemical, and you're getting that into your body, and that's where tumors and cancers come from, are these chemicals that we're willingly feeding our family off this cheap cookware out of Walmart.
Oh, okay. All right. You heard it from Bruce, who's Ketchum, like Ketchum, almost like Ketchup. He worked with the Kitchen Craft.
Kitchen Craft Cookware.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, Willie.
So, Willie Terry here at the Vegan Fest in a metal booth called Life by Chocolate. And it's an African-American business. I'm getting ready to talk to the owner of the business, and his name is
Webster Carroll.
Okay, how you doing?
My wife, she's also owning the business, Andrea Carroll. Yeah.
Okay, Webster
yeah.
Andrea.
And Leia Carroll. That's our daughter.
That's your daughter. So, so it's a family business.
Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little history of your business, how you got started.
Well, how we got started, actually started with our fellowship. We started learning about different diets, vegan, vegetarian, and then raw and living foods. So my wife and I, about 9 years ago, became raw and vegan. And this whole business is an outgrowth of that. What we wanted to do is, and a lot of times you hear about vegan food, people think of cardboard or they think of something that doesn't taste really good. And we began to experiment with different, you know, recipes and stuff like that. And one of these recipes were the chocolates that we made. And we wanted to share that, you know, with our community. So what we did was we did like a taster for our local community. We live up in a small town named Salem, New York, and also Cambridge, New York, which is a part of that community. Did a taster and was well received. And what rated really high, you know, on all the foods that we were presenting was the chocolates. So in about 2015, we went into business and started sharing those chocolates. We started at farmers markets first, and then we eventually got our chocolates into Honest Weight, into Healthy Living, and also into Four Seasons Natural Foods in Saratoga.
So your whole family is vegan?
Well, no, not all of us. It's just Andrea and ourselves, but they eat healthy.
Now, they say that chocolate is healthy for you, like a dark chocolate. Mm-hmm. What do you use, kind of dark chocolate?
Yeah, well, our product is made with, it's 100% cacao, so it's all dark chocolate. So there's no milk or anything like this because it's vegan. And we mix it with a coconut manna to make it, give it this fudge-type consistency. And we use nuts and, you know, and other ingredients in it. Like we sweeten it with agave nectar and that kind of thing. So there's no milk or anything like that in it. So.
Now, where's your product distributed from? I mean, how could someone get your product?
Get your product? They could actually get it at Healthy Living Market Cafe up in Saratoga, New York, and also in in Four Seasons Natural Foods. They're both in Saratoga Springs. So that's pretty much where you can get it.
You have a website?
We have a website, but it's under construction.
So when they're looking for this chocolate, they just look for the Life by Chocolate?
Life by Chocolate, yeah. 129 Life by Chocolate. Yeah.
Thank you. Let me just ask you another question. Now, since you went vegan, how's that health-wise?
Well, health-wise, what has happened is I lost like 100 pounds. I was like 300 pounds. And I got down to 200 pounds and kind of leveled out. I had more energy. I was able to exercise, you know, because before it was really tough trying to do that. My blood pressure went down, you know, lower cholesterol, everything.
All right. I want to thank you for those comments. And, you heard it. Life by Chocolate. Thank you.
And that was Hudson Mohawk Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaking to those who attended the Albany Vegan Festival. And if everything's working right, we're speaking live right now with Sandy Steubing and Mark Dunley of PAWS, or People of Albany United for Safe Energy. Hello.
Are you there, Sandy?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
And Mark's also here with us. So you two are the main organizers for the strike taking place this Friday, September 20th. Can you tell us what it's about?
Do you want to do that, Mark, or shall I go?
Sandy, why don't you take that? And then we'll alternate.
Okay. So, yes. Could you repeat the question? Why are we doing this? Was that your question?
Yeah, what's the strike about, and what is PAWS doing?
So the strike is originally Greta Thunberg's call to action. She's the teen from Sweden who was so successful last year in the student strikes around the world, including here in Albany. And she has called for the adults to join the students starting September 20th. And actually, it's a whole week of action. Other actions will also be here in the Capital District. But we're focused on Friday, September 20th. And we're joining the students from Albany High and the University of Albany in both a march and a rally. To bring awareness to the fact that our governments aren't doing nearly enough to address the climate situation, especially since the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change says we have until 2030 at the most before we reach the tipping point. And then after that, we can't claw back our climate to anything resembling normal.
And so what are you asking specifically? I assume that you're bringing grievances to the governor to do?
Yeah, the governor is sort of our main target for the event. Now, obviously, the state earlier this year did pass the Climate and Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, but we need them to go further. We particularly want them to call for a climate emergency, that literally the future of life on this planet is threatened. A couple of specific things are that we need to stop building any new, fossil fuel infrastructure. Yes, we want to move as quickly as possible to build more wind and solar and geothermal. But at the same time, we have to make sure that we're cutting our carbon emissions. And reality is, in New York to date, we really focused a lot on trying to reduce the emissions from electricity, which is actually the easiest thing to do and only accounts for about 20 to 25% of the carbon emissions. The big parts are buildings and transportation. We have to stop building all these new fossil fuel plants, like the one that the governor was trying to build down in the low-income neighborhood on Sheridan Avenue, which is why we're starting the march there at 11 a.m. on Friday at 79 Sheridan Avenue. And we also want to do other things like trying to get the state to stop subsidizing fossil fuels. We give about $1.4 billion a year in subsidies. We invest $11 billion in our state pension plans into fossil fuel companies. And we also continue to subsidize people hooking up their homes to natural gas. Natural gas, which is methane, is actually 80 times more potent as a greenhouse gas short-term than carbon. So in many ways, natural gas plants are worse for climate change than oil or coal plants. And we need to sort of move off of that, and we need to increase subsidies for things such as renewable heat and geothermal. We have about four or five other things that we can also bring up.
Can you give us the logistics of the day? Where is it starting? Where do people park? Where are you going?
Time.
Okay, so I'll take that one. As Mark said, we're starting at 79 Sheridan Avenue, which is where the current steam plant is located and where the state had been advocating and maybe still is for a brand new fossil fuel plant based on natural gas, and that would last 30 years or more. So that simply is unacceptable with our situation in the climate crisis. There are actually going to be three legs of the march, and the one Mark and I are talking about is the older activist leg that pauses organizing. It starts at 79. It starts at the Sheridan Power Plant. We're going to go down to the Department of Environmental Conservation because we need to protest that they're still giving out permits for fossil fuel projects. So we're stopping there. We're stopping at the Dormitory Authority of New York because we want to compliment them and thank them for the solar panels they put on their building and other conservation measures they pursued. We're going to go up to the comptroller's office, and Mr. DiNapoli is still investing our state pension funds into fossil fuel industry, and it is way, way past time for him to stop the divestment, which also isn't economically sound either. So after the comptroller, we're going over to the TD Bank, which funded the Dakota Access Pipeline and funds other fossil fuel projects as well. And finally, we're going to end up, our final protest will be at the Public Service Commission that isn't even holding the current rather weak climate goals that the state has. Hopefully we'll meet the other two legs of the march, one from Albany High, one from the University of Albany, and all march in together into the West Capitol Park where the students have organized a rally.
And that's at 1 o'clock.
And that's at 1 o'clock, yes.
And so when is the beginning of this march starting?
So the march starts at 11 at 79 Sheridan Avenue. We suggested people can take the bus to get there. Or you can park, and if people know Albany, they know how to park. We will end up at the Capitol.
How do you get the word out to promote the strike and raise awareness?
We go on WOOC 18 times between now and Friday. We have about 25, 30 different groups who have co-sponsoring the event. Sandy's probably better than I can maybe, list some of them. A number of faith organizations, other, environmental groups. So they're certainly pushing it out to their own membership. We obviously post a lot on, Facebook and Twitter. And other social media stuff. We hand out, flyers at other events, and a lot of it's word of mouth. And of course, we run Democracy Now! Here on WOOC. And so Greta Thunberg was on, Amy's show a couple of days ago, Greta being the young activist from Sweden, and she was on The Daily Show, last week. So I think there's really been a lot of attention to the climate strike in general, not so much our particular event. I think there's 8 or 9 events taking place just in New York State on Friday, and worldwide maybe, I don't know, 400, 500, 600 events. The last time they did a climate strike, they claim it was the largest single climate protest in history. I think it was well over 1.5 million, and they expect this will be the largest event ever. And one of the things they're doing more than the last event, which is why people like Sandy and I are involved, is they really want a senior citizens, more of the adults showing up this time to join with the students. Students are still, you know, the voice. And I think one of the things is really that students, you know, say, listen, you old guys had 30 years that you've known that climate is a real problem. And frankly, you've done nothing for 30 years. And now you put us in this situation where literally our lives are threatened. The lies, you know, should we have children to bring them into this world where extreme weather is going to become so routine? You guys have to start acting. And that's why we want to call it a climate emergency. You know, we need to treat this like we, you know, the United States treated the attack on Pearl Harbor. We have to mobilize all resources, you know, and we can't spend 10 years or more to build out solar and wind facilities, which is the case right now. Since Governor Pataki in 2002 set some, you know, modest climate goals, the reality is over, 17 years, New York State added a grand total of 5% of its state electricity coming from wind and solar. To meet what we would say are the limited goal of getting 70% of the state electricity from renewables by 2030, we have to add 5% each year now coming from wind and solar. So what we've done in 17 years, we now have to do annual, and electricity is the easiest. We got to convert to electric buses and electric cars. We got to get out of the cars and onto mass transit and bicycles. California requires new buildings now, especially residential buildings, to be net zero carbon emissions. And if you are less than 3 stories on your new buildings, new homes, they must include solar. You know, there's this myth that the United States is the cutting edge on the environment. That hasn't been true for 30 years. We are so far behind the rest of the country. I'm sorry, the rest of the world. And even you go in places like Massachusetts, you drive down their thruway, you see solar everywhere. And here in the Capital District, so seldom do you see any solar panels up.
What can people do if they can't attend? This is a call for a general strike, correct?
This is a call for a general strike. And one of the things that they can do is just find the nearest climate organization, climate action organization to join. If they're in Albany or nearby in Troy, they can join PAWS. But there's lots of other organizations as well,
such as Extinction Rebellion.
Extinction Rebellion, yes, and they're centered in Troy, so that would be a very good organization for people to join.
Sandy actually got arrested with Extinction Rebellion down in New York City.
Yes, I did.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm sorry that we have to cut the conversation short, but stay tuned. We'll have more coverage of this event on the general strike on Friday. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, WOOC.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Christopher Scully.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Our engineer tonight is Sophia Cahillane. Did I say that right? Cahillane. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. And if you have comments, suggestions, or a hot tip, don't forget to email us at at mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just show up at one of our weekly meetings Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.